passion and pageantry of college football lives here. This is the Paul Feinbaum Show, Hour 3 Podcast.
This might be college football heaven. Yeah.
We are back, the second half of the show, and it's been a pretty entertaining show. I hope you heard from Tyrion Arnold earlier, one of the better interviews we've had all year. We get back to the calls right now, and Ronnie is up next in Alabama. Hello, Ronnie.
Hello, Paul. Appreciate you taking my call.
Thank you.
I've got three comments to make, and the last comment is about Alabama, and I hope you promise not to cut me off till I get all the way through. But anyway, my first comment is that Iceman and Bash from Colorado, they need to call each other because both of them don't never say nothing. Okay, and my second comment is Ben and Virginia. He needs to move to Michigan. He needs to move to Michigan. That's a good place for him. And my comment on Alabama, I'm an Alabama fan. Alabama's got a long way to go, but if they get some help, they'll be in the college football playoff. I feel like they would have a tough time, but I feel like they'll beat Georgia. And I hope that some of the other teams lose. I'd like to see Alabama and Georgia both in the playoffs. And Texas, I hope they make it to the playoffs. And I hope Alabama can have an opportunity to play them in the semifinals and beat them and play Georgia for the national championship and win. Roll Tide, roll.
Jim is up next. Go right ahead, Jim. Good afternoon.
Hey, Paul, thanks for the call. I just wanted to ask you about the Alabama defense. I don't know if there's a better defense out there. Can you name a college football team?
I think they would be top two or three. Michigan would be up there. Georgia would be in that conversation.
Paul, you also spoke yesterday's show, 2009-2015, I believe, if I'm correct, we were underdogs. And now we're underdogs probably going into this SEC championship
as a nice little trend. This will be the fourth time Alabama has been an underdog since 2009. Alabama was an underdog against Florida, and they've been an underdog. This will be the third time against Georgia they've been an underdog. In 15, when Alabama won by about four touchdowns, in Atlanta when Alabama won. And again, I think the national championship game may have gone off as Georgia is a one-point favorite. Originally, Alabama was a favorite, and the line moved leading up to the kickoff. But those are the only times. Thank you very, very much for the call. Joseph is in Tupelo. You're on the air.
Hey, Mr. Paul. Thanks for taking my call.
Thank you.
I've got a couple things to say, but first off, I got to apologize. I mean, I know I said starting the season, I thought maybe we'd probably be 11-1. No, but Rebels aren't. And we got embarrassed Saturday. It was horrible. I can't believe it. I mean, it was just pathetic. I mean, and then we got a quarterback hurt. So I still think we might end up 10-2, but who knows? But also, that caller you had earlier today, I think his name was Trey. He was talking about Art Briles. I mean, it's an embarrassment that he's even was coaching high school football from the program that he headed that allowed prostitution and whatnot. I mean, I don't know. I just can't believe that. But I wanted also to hear what bowl game do you think the Rebels will get to if we finish 10-2?
Well, I think 10-2 would probably get Ole Miss into a New Year's Six game. And definitely if Alabama and Georgia somehow both made the playoffs. But I think 10-2 is enough. What Ole Miss has to do is finish, I believe, in the top 12, which I think they can. There's a couple of factors that go into that. Hey, thank you, Joseph. Appreciate the call. And John is up next in Gulf Shores. Hey, John.
Hello, Paul. How are you guys today?
We're doing great. Thank you.
Good. I was just curious. I've been listening in and out as the day is going on, but I thought I wanted to get your thoughts. It might be far-fetched, but what about Dan Mullins going back to Mississippi State as a possible? I mean, he had a lot of success there, and I thought maybe, you know, they might be able to get him for a good price, possibly. What's your thoughts on that, sir?
I think the chances would be infinitesimal. No chance. It's not because Dan Mullen isn't a good coach. It's not because you just have to understand the mindset of the Mississippi State people, the way Dan Mullen left, the bad feelings, and I give it zero chance.
Okay, well, I appreciate that, Paul. You do an outstanding job. Thank you.
Yeah, and I understand why people think that. It's logical to think that, man, he was great there. He was. But you also have to know Dan Mullen. And it's always important, not to give a lecture here, but when you leave someplace, how you leave, especially when you're going someplace else, that's better. And that is why Dan Mullen would not be considered, the way he left and the friction that was created over certain situations. Mo is up next in Knoxville, Tennessee. Hey, Mo.
Hey, Paul, thanks for taking my call.
Thank you.
I just have a question. With all this Jaden Daniels hype for Heisman, I just don't understand how that's possible when he's only taken LSU to 9-3, and Hendon Hooker last year got left out of even being a finalist, and he took Tennessee to a historic season. So I just kind of want to hear your thoughts about that.
Well, I think circumstances are different. The one thing about Hendon Hooker, he didn't finish the season, which really did hinder his chances because of the injury. And I understand people loving on Jaden Daniels. He played a good game against Alabama. He got hurt. It wasn't a vintage Jaden Daniels game because the Alabama defense was so tough. But I think he has – the numbers are not the only thing that matters. There's a lot to it. And I appreciate the gentleman earlier reading the Heisman description, but very few people follow that. We get hung up on other things. It's a fact. May not be right, but it's a fact. Nick is up next in Missouri. Hello, Nick. Good afternoon.
Hey, Paul. I want your thoughts on those Missouri Tigers.
Incredibly impressive. I really think they're one of the toughest teams in the country. I think Drink has done a phenomenal job. And probably the only fault I have with this season is letting that LSU game slip away. The Georgia game was expected. That didn't surprise anyone.
Yeah. You think there's any shots at the New York Six Bowls?
Oh, absolutely. Yes. I think it's going to be – I'll get the exact definition. I had it explained to me today, and I've already I think it's, you know, top 10 definitely gets you in there. There's some variables that go into it, but I think right now you're looking at Ole Miss and Missouri as strong contenders for the New Year's Six. A little bit depends on what happens in the Big Ten and in the SEC, because those are really the only leagues that have a shot at maybe getting two schools in the CFP. But I think Missouri in the CFP is landmark. Missouri in the New Year's Six is just amazing when you think about what this program has overcome and the patience that the school gave to Coach Drink to turn it around. Thank you for the call. Appreciate it. And let's check in with Tony next in Tuscaloosa. Hey, Tony.
Hey, Paul. How you doing?
We are doing great.
Roll Tide. I just want to tell you, I got a feeling that Jalen Milroe will be Alabama's next Heisman Trophy winner 2024. What do you think?
Well, he could. He has made about the most marked improvement of any player I've seen all year.
I agree with you on that.
Hey, thank you for the call. We're heading to a break. We We still have a few more guests. We have time for more of your phone calls. We are still fairly early in the second half of the program, and we'll be right back.
You're listening to the Paul Feinbaum Show podcast.
We are back, and we appreciate your being here. How about Gary next up in Wyoming? Hello, Gary.
Hey, Paul. Thanks for taking my call.
Thank you.
Hey, I watched you this morning on with Stephen A. and Shannon and them, and I just want to say, among other things, Shannon Sharpe's analogy regarding Jim Harbaugh, as far as, you're taking tests and cheating all the time until you get to the final dance, and then you get caught and you're not cheating anymore. Should you be awarded the big trophy if you're no longer cheating, but you did it the entire time? And it's like, well, if you get to that point to where you're not cheating anymore after you did it all that time, I think they're being a little too critical of Harbaugh in some respects, Paul. I think there's a lot of other teams out there that are doing the very same thing, and he just happened to have gotten caught. And if that team beats Ohio State without him and then does it again, I think they're entitled to be in the big dance.
Yeah, I mean, Gary, first of all, whatever I believe may have been hard to get across during that, I've never quite felt like a stranger while sitting live on national television, because there was almost no way to break into that scream fest. But I fully support what you said. My point about Harbaugh has been that something needed to be done by the Big Ten to send a message. This is not the final disposition of the case. That will come years down the road. But the Big Ten commissioner was certainly within his right. And I want to make one other point that I never could get across today. I started to, and then the food fight broke out. But when Jim Harbaugh signed his contract with the University of Michigan, he ceded his rights to due process. He agreed that he will follow the NCAA rules. Or be dismissed with cause, and quite frankly, a lot of people just simply are confused by this whole issue, and I don't believe they should be kept out of the CFP. I think Stephen A. is completely off his rocker on that.
I do too. I mean, and I sure am not a Michigan fan. But you look at what Harbaugh did. I mean, he took a heck of a pay cut and really tried to put that program together when he had the fire on his feet. And, you know, I think they've really exaggerated and really monstronized the guy to a point.
I have a lot of friends who communicate with me, and they strongly believe that the NCAA has been out to get him. And part of the reason goes back to the previous case. And there's no way to simplify what he was accused of. It really wasn't very much. He created more in his lack of cooperation. If he had just simply signed off on it, it would have been over. And I know. He's a true believer. There is no bend in Jim Harbaugh. And sometimes you just have to go along to get along. And because he would not do that, he got leveled with that 3-game suspension, and it is a mitigating factor. When the Big Ten commissioner is reacting, and I believe too, the Big Ten commissioner had enough evidence to push him to do that. And if it's turned over by this judge on Friday, good for them. It doesn't matter to me. Frankly, I'm other than Jim Harbaugh, I'm about as sick of this story as any I've ever covered.
I'm glad you are, Paul, because it's like nobody even mentions the kids. And I mentioned this on your show before. It never gets brought up about the kids and the amount of time that they've put into it, just like all the others. But a lot of these kids could have went to the draft last year, and they came back because they knew that they had a shot at the title. And that doesn't even get mentioned.
Thank you very much, Gary. And yeah, they're very likely to be back here in a couple of weeks. And it will ratchet up the excitement and the interest if if we have a Georgia slash Alabama Michigan final. That I would not want to miss that. Let's check in with Joseph in Athens, Georgia. Hey, Joseph.
Hey, Paul. First of all, I just want to thank you for being one of the guys, one of the only guys on TV to still be talking about the back-to-back national champions and giving Georgia its true respect. But my question is for you, what are the chances Georgia still makes the playoff if they lose to Alabama in the SEC, considering there are probably going to be two undefeated teams left in the playoffs?
I think it's a narrow path, and unfortunately it goes back to the same thing we've been talking about now for a year and a half, and that's the lack of that Oklahoma game. That could really loom large. Now, Michigan doesn't have a game either, but Ohio State does. Ohio State did go to Notre Dame, and that game remains very significant.
Agreed. And my second question for you, Paul, is what's your prediction this weekend in Tennessee?
I always like to wait till I get there, but it would take a lot of convincing for me to believe Tennessee can beat Georgia.
I agree, but there are other opinions this weekend in Athens for the Ole Miss Georgia game.
Yeah, and I know people will tell me Friday, hey, you know, you don't know what it's like to play in Neyland Stadium. Well, I do, but
yeah, I know you.
I think Georgia. I think it's still a scary game, and knowing Kirby Smart like I do, he is driving that point in. Tennessee is capable. I think with some experts around me, I'm not capable of myself, draw up a path for them to win, but it is razor thin, though.
Gotcha. Well, Paul, I appreciate your time.
Thank you very much. Good to hear from you, really. Tyler in Georgia. Hey, Tyler, go right ahead.
Hey, Paul, Roll Tide. I had a couple of questions. What do you think about the Alabama-Georgia game? And if Alabama wins, do you think we will be in the playoff?
Tyler, I believe Alabama should be in the playoffs if they get past that. And I know what everybody's going to say, and we'll hear it again tonight, and we'll hear it for the next 2 weeks. But they have a high-quality loss. And what they would really have going for them is this. There's one caveat. If Ohio State beats Michigan, I think that would be the best win of the year in college football. Georgia losing would be on the same level of that by Alabama, but I think it would be one of the two best wins of the year. That's significant. And if Texas wins out, then they have also one of the better losses. So that is a good combination. What's most important to me is the way Alabama would have played in the final three quarters of the year. They're playing at an elite level. They weren't early on, but they are now. And that's what this 12-person committee should judge them on.
Yes, sir. And do you think Milroe has any chance of this year maybe making it to the final three Heisman candidates?
I think he has a chance if it's a big field, meaning five. Sometimes they do have five people up there, or do they only have three? I can't remember. They may have changed that rule. I think what you have to have is a certain percent. Because in the past they have had five different people up there, but I mean it's unlikely, but you know, a huge game against Auburn, a monster game against Georgia, and as I sit there on that Sunday afternoon voting, I could easily be persuaded to leave somebody else out to put Milroe in my top three. Thanks for the call. We are heading to a break. We have a lot to do the rest of the way. We'll talk about buyouts and how we got to a point where $77 million almost seems like a normal day. It's really not when you pay a coach to leave. Paula Levine from ESPN, the preeminent investigative reporter in sports, will join us next.
You're listening to the Paul Feinbaum Show podcast.
Welcome back. So much has been made of what Texas A&M announced on Sunday night, the nearly $77 million in buyout to Jimbo Fisher. Paul Levine, a preeminent investigative reporter for ESPN, has done a piece and discovered that $146 million in buyouts are owed to Power 5 coaches just in the last year. Paula, great to see you again. What an unbelievable subject that we're addressing here. Tell us about your reporting.
Always a pleasure to join you, and always enjoy talking about athletic departments just tossing around millions of dollars. Yeah, Jimbo Fisher's payout is record-setting. Everything's bigger in Texas. Obviously, that includes buyouts. But it is part of a trajectory of buyouts that we're seeing that is on a pace that sort of eclipses what we've seen in the past. So, as you mentioned, we took a look at just head football coaches since August of last year, and with Fisher's buyout, it's about $146 million in dead money, what we consider dead money, money that schools are paying coaches not to coach. Now, a couple years ago, we looked at the dead money over an 11-year period from, like, you know, 2010 through 2021, and we looked at head football coaches, men's basketball coaches, women's basketball coaches, assistants, and the total was like $533 million. So just this tiny segment is more than a quarter of that amount, which shows you that, like, the pace and the amounts are just picking up and they're taking off. It is a sign. I mean, we talk about the arms race and we talk about these contracts that these schools get into, but this buyout, even though everybody's talking about it being such an outlier, and it is, seems to be part of an overall trend of schools just signing these contracts and paying out and somehow finding the money to do that.
Paul, I want to be careful here to ask you about why all this happens, because I feel like doing the show, I probably have a pretty good idea. But I'm particularly interested in comparing these negotiations that athletic directors have with coaches, and you juxtapose that with the rest of the world, and it's not the same universe, is it?
Oh gosh, no. I mean, that's the crazy thing. Like, when I think about this, I think about the very sort of unsexy conversations that the general counsel or the university's, like, contract experts who do this all the time, who have got to be people who are good in their fields. I just wonder how they sit down and they construct these contracts that basically say, okay, so we're going to pay out all of this money if we decide essentially that this coach just isn't really doing what we expect him or her to do. And yeah, you've got the you know, fired for cause, but those don't include performance issues. And you're right, you don't get this in other lines of work. And the idea that you would let someone go because you're not happy with that person's performance, yet essentially just pay out what you would have paid out had that person performed well for the next however many years, that doesn't necessarily have a parallel in the real world. And it just speaks to this, you know, this competitiveness, this what, you know, athletic directors and presidents I've talked to in the past have called just the cost of doing business. And it's, you know, and even in some of the comments that the athletic director at Texas A&M has said, it's like, you know, we'll find the money to do this. We'll get this out of our athletic department. It's like that sort of attitude makes you think that this is just, it is. It's really something that they just sort of factor into it. And it does not have a parallel in what you and I consider the real world.
Chatting with Paula Levine, it's always so great to talk to her. Paula, there seems to be some commonality here that I've noticed, and there are several agencies, talent agencies, that represent the lion's share of these coaches. And I wonder when one particular agent, in this case Jimmy Sexton, who was with CAA, represents 10 or 11 of the 14 SEC coaches, and he represents basketball coaches and baseball coaches, probably even represents athletic directors for all we know. It just seems like these are not fair negotiations.
Yeah, his name has come up quite often when I speak to university presidents about, in particular, just wishing that he were not in the room, right? And that makes sense. And yeah, I mean, it is kind of crazy that one person can have such control over this. But I think so much of it comes down to, I mean, my gosh, he's got to be an amazing negotiator, right? But so much of it comes down to this, the presidents and then the pressure that they're getting from the donors and from the boosters that, you know, that they're being told, oh, well, if you don't do this, you know, this other university is going to snatch him up. And I think a lot of that is sort of constructed by the people who represent them, by the Jimmy Sextons. And it is, it's an incredible influence. It really is. And I, you know, I think and the power of the donors, like I want to talk about that a little bit, because the power of the donors is really something that is of quite a bit of debate here, because I think what people will say, and this is even, you know, came out with what the A&M athletic director said, is, you know, we've got people, we've got the foundation, you know, that'll take care of some of this. And you could argue, well, yeah, okay, so you've got donors out there who are willing to foot the bill for this. But, you know, you talk to some of the experts here, and they'll say, especially at a public university, you know, any of that money that's coming in and any of the money that's coming to the athletic department, I mean, that's still state money. And the question is, okay, so what's the opportunity cost? And this is where you can really have the debate back and forth, which is, okay, is there some donor out there in West Texas, some oil man who's saying, oh, you know, I was gonna donate $50 million to the English department or the women's studies program, and gosh, now I'm gonna have to use that money to pay off this buyout. I don't necessarily know that there's that sort of parallel, but I think there is a legitimate argument that there's this money out there that obviously that the donors and the boosters have. And could it have gone to other uses at the university? Would that money have been donated if it weren't for this particular need for the buyout? And I think that's a legitimate argument. I mean, I got an email this afternoon from someone, a law firm representing someone who's actually filed a complaint with the IRS claiming that this, you know, that the foundation is actually not doing nonprofit work, and that there's a line in this thing that's saying they're actually taking, you know, money, or they're taking food away from children who are hungry, and they're interfering with other nonprofit activities like protecting people from human trafficking. I mean, it's very dramatic. And so I don't know about going that far, but I do think that there's an argument about the opportunity cost with your money coming from the donors, even if it's not money that is, you know, that you're going to have to take out of your existing program.
And Paul, piggybacking that, I know you've done a lot of reporting on NIL, but in collectives, and you start thinking all the money, I mean, we're talking tens of millions of dollars at various schools that are going into that. At some point, some department is getting the short end of the stick. I mean, I don't think it's hard to draw a straight line, but you do have to wonder about the future of higher education.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and you're right. You made a very good point. It is hard to draw a straight line, because it is hard to say, well, you know, is that money that is actually targeted for some other area that's now being taken away from there? You know, it's hard to say. But, you know, you mentioned NIL, and I think there is an interesting parallel here with NIL. And in terms of what I was talking about, where the money's going and where it's not going, you know, one of the factors, you know, we talk about the competitiveness of the coaches and people saying, well, you know, this is what a free market does. Well, you've got a lot of people who are arguing that, well, it's actually not a free market, because you've got these coaches who are able to get this money based on what, you know, advocates for athletes are saying is unpaid labor. And so the question is whether you're talking about money going to NIL deals or whether you're talking about maybe some eventual payment situation for the athletes. You know, is that something that might get these coaching contracts and these buyout provisions under control or bringing them down? Because you talk about the opportunity cost of donors. Well, you know, are they going to see in the future it being more advantageous to direct money to the athletes, whether it's through NIL or through some other mechanism, versus the coaches? And I also question that right now in terms of these third-party deals that the coaches are getting from the apparel companies. I mean, I think we need a few years to see how this pans out, because a lot of those contracts have been in place for some time. But will we see in the future these apparel companies trimming down the money that they're giving to the coaches, because now they can give it directly to the athletes? And I think that sort of, that whole fact, you can't really untie all of this from NIL, because I think it all factors in, because again, it's all, where is the money going? And for the people who care about the program, where are they seeing the biggest bang for their buck?
Amazing. It never ends. I guess on one level, that's good for both of us. There's a lot of unmined reporting out there for you. Paula, great to have you on. Fantastic job of this story, and look forward to seeing you soon. Thank you very much. Paula Levine joining us from ESPN on the subject of the week in the SEC. We'll take a short break. Back with more.
You're listening to the Paul Feinbaum Show podcast.
Let's head to Louisiana and speak to May. Good afternoon, May.
Well, hi, Paul. How are you?
We are doing great. Thank you so much.
I'm 82 years old, and I stand 4 feet 9 inches tall and weigh 115 pounds, and I got a big gripe.
Well, before you have your gripe, I want to say, before you have your gripe, you sound like a wonderful lady. It's a pleasure to meet you.
Oh, don't butter me up.
You saw right through that, didn't you?
Yes, I did.
Okay,
yes, well, I did.
I plead guilty.
I miss Tammy on your show. She used to stand up to you.
Okay,
Paul, getting to our little Jaden Daniels. That's a fine little man. This caller that was from Louisiana put everything into perspective. How come they don't put this, feed everything into a computer? There would be no bias.
Oh, I don't know. There might be. Computers are infallible, or not infallible.
No, they're not.
maybe you know more than I do. I assume you do, but so you're saying we should have a computer pick the Heisman Trophy?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Feed everything that he's done.
I'll go against what I said a minute ago about complimenting. I think that's a terrible idea.
Why?
Well, because computers don't see every aspect. They only look at numbers, and we're not awarding the trophy to the athlete who has the best power rating or the best numbers. We're awarding it to who we think is the most outstanding player. And I think you also have the freedom as a voter to interpret what that means, not only to your individual self, but to your football team. That it's a team sport. You know that, don't you, May?
Yes, I do. But you're saying what you're seeing on the field. That's
well,
what
you know. What, you know why
them?
your statement is flawed, because you have a game like this weekend when LSU is playing an also ran, and the temptation for Brian Kelly in the Georgia State game would be to leave Jaden Daniel in for the entire game so he could get 10 touchdowns as opposed to bring in the backups, and that would be of no purpose whatsoever. It risks him getting injured in a meaningless game.
Yeah. No, but what I'm saying, you said the visual, seeing on the field how they play, y'all judge by that, right?
Well, but let's stick to the statistics. The statistics don't always... I mean, they capture a big part of the story, but not the complete story.
I don't know. In my eyes, that's not right.
Okay.
I just think it's so biased.
So why do you think we are biased? What have I said that you don't agree with?
Paul, you're gonna stand there and say, you're not for Alabama. Everything that comes out your mouth is Alabama, Alabama, Alabama. We don't hate Alabama. We're just tired of hearing it.
So you think you believe that I am biased toward Alabama, correct?
Yes, 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 yes.
Can you name something that I've said about LSU this year is biased?
Not per se. No, not really.
I've talked to your head coach every Monday of the college football season. It's one of our favorite segments.
How,
I don't know what else I can do.
Why is he going on there every week?
Why? Well, let me try to explain it. He's reaching millions of people promoting the LSU brand. You don't think that's a good idea?
Yeah, well, the people that really needs to be promoted already seeing. We're anybody in Louisiana for LSU.
May, where in Louisiana do you live?
Sugartown.
Okay. So the people in Sugartown know who he is, and Bayou La Batre and Shreveport and Monroe and Morgan City and all these places in Louisiana.
I'm originally from Morgan City.
Okay, but my point is that people from all over the country watch this show, and you don't think there are high school football players that may walk in someplace and see this show on a Monday when we're talking to Brian Kelly that might matter to the program. I mean, Jaden's from California.
Yes, but I do know that. He played for Arkansas. He's a fine young man.
We actually played for Arizona State.
I love him to death. And you said something about Daniels, that Kelly should be talking up for him. Mm-hmm. I do every day. But
May, are you able to travel at your age?
Sure. Okay. Listen, I cut my grass on the tractor. I take care of 5 acres of land cutting grass in my yard.
Well, I wonder if the university shouldn't send you up to New York instead of Jaden and let you go on The View and maybe some of the other shows and promote Jaden for Heisman. I think you have a better chance of getting him the Heisman than somebody in Louisiana.
I tell you what, he's a fine little person. And we sure like Kelly, too. He's a fine person. But anyhow, I can't see him missing out this year. Let me get back to something else.
Okay.
When we played Alabama, when they took him out, that should have been where that Turner...
You're listening to the Paul Feinbaum Show podcast.